Okay, and I need to do a little disclaimer here. Neither Jim or I are attorneys, lawyers, tax professionals, bankers, or currency dealers. And should you need the services of these professionals, you should seek independent counsel from them. I would like to introduce my associate, Jim Knox. Jim has been in the trust business actually a little longer than my husband and I have been. And we have been working together for, what, 20 years now, Jim, something like that?
Oh, a little bit more than that. So we started together in, I guess we met in 96, 97, so about 21, 22 years.
Yeah, it's been a while.
Yes,
so, you know, once again, as most of you know, or many of you know, we have been moving. My husband and I recently moved to a new home in Oklahoma. We're still getting settled. We have had iffy, if any, internet service. Hopefully it will be a little better now. I mean, last week I had to do this call from inside my car in a parking lot to get free Wi-Fi, but at least now I'm home. So... So I appreciate all of you for bearing with us through this difficult time. We have had several issues aside with, you know, related to moving. But so we do want to talk about trust today and about what to do with your trust. You know, as many of you have listened to me before, what we sell is a contract business trust, even though we do not use the word business because a lot of people, including banks, find it very, very confusing. But, you know, most currency holders have heard of or researched corporations, LLCs, statutory trusts, common law trusts, and other entities. And, you know, most of us are aware that most businesses are organized as corporations, partnerships, or sole proprietorships. An even better way to organize a business is with a common law trust, also known as a business trust. Just because it is a business trust doesn't mean you have to operate a business. The business of this common law business trust is estate planning and asset protection. One of the beauties of this trust is that you are able to become your own trustee. So what it essentially comes down to is there's nobody between you and your money. And, folks, most of us realize when this event occurs, we are going to have a lot of money. And anybody... Any of you that think, well, we can get away, well, I can manage all this. You know, I'm a pretty smart guy, pretty smart woman. I can handle all this money on my own. But I think most of us are looking at probably having several million dollars. I would hazard a guess that most of us are not experienced with that kind of money. We are going to need some help. The trust itself is fairly easy to operate. We give you detailed written instructions with the trust to begin with, plus access to our website, which is Jim has just loaded with all kinds of information to make navigating your trust much easier. But one of the things we really want to talk to you about today is managing the trust and your money. Jim, would you like to expound on that a little bit?
Sure. My personal history is interesting in as much as I had multiple companies at one time and I was running them. And what I ended up doing is hiring a personal assistant. I shopped, I found the individual that could do the job. And then I placed a personal assistant type person in each one of the companies. It was four companies. And so the personal assistants liaisoned together, and then my personal assistant would only bring me the things that I needed to review. I had set it up to where every entity was self-directed. In other words, they had a president, had a vice president, you know, that they knew what they were doing. So it took the burden off of me. And at the one time when I was doing this, I got it down to where I could only had to work Tuesday, Wednesdays, and Thursdays. And then I was only available on other times if it was an emergency where they had to get hold of me, which that never happened. But the biggest thing we're going to have to do is you're going to have to learn to delegate. You know, you're going to have all these projects going on, all these companies going on, all this money sitting out there. You have to learn to delegate. You cannot do it yourself. Now, what I did is I found a headhunter company. It was based in Seattle at that time. And they went and found me the people to run my companies. I was trying to do it by myself, and it about drove me crazy. Crazier. And so the headhunter company, they would go out and find somebody that was already working someplace else to make them a better offer. And they migrated to my state, which is Alaska at the time. And they worked for me. It worked out really, really well. Now, what I also found is I had to see the financials every week. We started out with once a month. That wasn't enough for me. I had to see the financials every week. So the people that liaison to me knew that every week on Wednesday they would bring me the current financials of that company. And that worked out real well for me. So I saw everything on a weekly basis. And I found that I had to create a staunch hierarchy of how I set these companies up. You know, you had to do it this way to make everything work. So I was insistent with the people that worked with me, you do it my way or it's the highway, basically, but you got to do it my way. Otherwise, my system fails, and I can't govern all of these entities, all of these companies. So that's my personal experience. So in a nutshell, you're going to have to hire somebody that you really trust. You're going to have to put them in a non-disclosure, non-compete, non-this, non-that agreement. You need to have everybody, basically. And that's the person that you're going to lean on to go to the other entities and see those people and make sure they're doing their job. You don't want to have to do that. You want to have somebody doing that. You want to make the major decisions. You don't want the pressure that would come from trying to run all these things to jaundice your decisions in a specific direction. That's my take on how to do this, and that's how I am going to do mine. Carol?
Hi, I totally agree. The number of people that I've spoken with that have the currencies and have trusts or contemplating getting a trust have a lot of projects in mind. None of us are really up to that. I mean, none of us can be expert at everything. And when you're juggling two or three different projects, you're going to need some help doing it. You know, personally, you know, Jim and I are both going to be in this business for at least another 6 months. My husband and I plan on just making major donations to a lot. So that's pretty invisible. I mean, we don't have to do much with that, but there are a few projects that we would like to be actively involved with. But to be actively involved doesn't mean on a day-to-day nature. It means, you know, we get involved. As Jim said, we hire people that are capable of running these companies who report back to us. I can hear somebody back in the background there. But anyway, I totally agree with Jim. We need to hire some professionals to help us manage this money in these projects. And I think, Jim, we have some non-disclosures and things that we would put on the website. Is that correct?
Yeah, we do. We have quite a bit on there. We're going to add a lot more. I have a list of all of the laws, the case histories and stuff that I want to put on there. We'll discuss where we're going to put that here shortly. But we've had some attorneys that have made negative comments, and we've corrected them. And I have a whole list, and I want to make that available to everybody probably by the end of the day on the website someplace. I'll figure out where. And I want everybody to be able to get a hold of this thing so they can see exactly how much horsepower this trust has. We have, you know, there's 30, 40 cases here. Some of them have been to the Supreme Court. The rules in our favor. And so we need to get that out so you don't have to listen to all the naysayers out there that have no real knowledge of what they're talking about. But because they have a license, they feel that I can say things that are stupid and not correct. Do we need to mute everything here, Carol? It's getting pretty noisy.
I'm having some difficulty with the controls on this conference call, so if you all do *6 to mute yourselves, that would be helpful, please. And
now we'll go to questions here in a minute, and everybody can *6, and we'll have a great time.
Yeah. There we go. Because I can do it from here and still have Jim talk. So if you just *6 yourself, I see a few of you are doing that. I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
So some of these cases that I'm going to be referring to, you can print them out and just keep them with you. Keep them in the trust. Keep them with you. If somebody starts giving you if you're trying to talk to one of your children or a husband about this or anything, you'll have these court cases. And you can say, look, this is the power that we're dealing with here. This has been down that road and it's proven to work and it's never been overturned. And we're talking hundreds of years of cases. I mean, going back into the 1700s, some of these. And it just shows you how long that they have been using these types of entities. Actually, started in the 1400s, but we won't go into that much of a history lesson. But
that's way before our time, Jim.
Yeah, just a smidge. Just a smidge.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, with that said, Carol, you want to add anything to that part?
Well, you know, as most of you who have listened to us before know by now, or should know, the trust that we offer was drafted by a fully licensed attorney who is now retired. We've received many accolades from a variety of sources over the country in the past 20-some years. To the best of our knowledge, when properly operated, it has never failed to meet any challenge, whether in tax court, civil court, criminal court, or even the U.S. Court of Appeals. Neither Jim nor myself or my mentor, Jim Jenkins, have ever had any problems, legal or tax problems, with this trust, nor have any of our clients to our knowledge, which, you know, you think about that, folks, that's a pretty good track record. My husband and I have been in this business since 1992. Jim was in it, Jim Jenkins, in the middle 80s. Jim, you were in the late 80s, right?
I got started in, first introduction was 1979 to all this, but I didn't get really started until about the mid-80s.
Yeah, so, I mean, think about that, folks. That's a long, long track record without any bumps in the road. So we're very, very proud of what we do. We have gone to great lengths to make sure that every trust that leaves us is carefully worded, following the, you know, the format that was written by this attorney. But due to our, most of our clientele right now are denarians or currency holders. Jim used to get quite a bit more money for these trusts. My husband and I used to get quite a bit more money for these trusts. But we have found that most of us denarians are pretty much currency rich and cash poor. So we made a conscious decision some time ago to reduce the price drastically from what it used to be to make it more affordable to denarians. We want to make sure that you have the best asset protection vehicle that is available. Somebody else may charge more money. Somebody else may charge less money. But we feel that we have the best there is to offer. We give you continued backup, as I mentioned, the website that Jim has created. And we always answer the phone. I mean, there have been a few times in the last couple of weeks during my move that the phone and email were not answered as promptly as they normally are. But typically, we answer every phone call and we answer every email. I have heard stories of other trust companies, people who have been involved with such and such a company, and they won't even answer their phone. How do you run a business without answering phone calls, folks? It's, you know, our support does not stop. And I know Jim has spent hours on the phone with several people, as have I. And we do not charge for these phone calls. If you have a question, we're happy to answer it in any way we can. Would you agree, Jim?
Yeah, I do spend a lot of time with people, and I learn a lot. They learn a lot, and it's kind of a synergistic experience for everybody because I ask a lot of questions to find out what they plan on doing, which helps me give them the right answers. And I've learned quite a bit. I mean, some of you people have got some good ideas. Kudos to you.
Yeah, really. I mean, good ideas with what they're planning to do and good projects and the humanitarian efforts that so many people are involved in or want to become involved in. That's a wonderful thing. You know, we're going to come into this wealth, and, you know, with great wealth comes great responsibility. Our responsibility at this point is to make sure some of it goes to humanitarian efforts. And, you know, I know there was talk some time ago of, you have a gym, it's got to be an 80-20 split or whatever. I don't think that those restraints are on us anymore, but I suspect most people are probably going to follow that kind of formula. One of the things that Jim was talking about earlier about hiring people to assist us, one of the first things you want to do, and you probably want to mention this at your exchange, is that you plan on working with a qualified trust management company and a wealth manager. I don't mean somebody that's going to run your trust on a day-to-day basis, but somebody that's going to help you to properly spend that money, but manage that money, make sure it goes into the right channels so you're not making all these decisions. You know, you and your spouse aren't sitting at the coffee table having a cup of coffee saying, well, maybe we should give $100,000 to our local YMCA. Well, you might want to do stuff like that. But you also might want to have those conversations with a wealth manager. Would you agree, Jim?
I would totally agree with that. You know, the more information you can get from professionals, the better and easier your life's going to be. You can't know it all. We don't know it all. We read constantly. We research. We think we're fairly well-versed in this particular subject, but we don't know how everything is about managing the money. We know that what we want to do, and we're actually looking for a professional to help us manage our money. And we're not giving you advice that we're not taking. We're doing this too.
That's for sure. That's for sure.
Yeah.
I know that Trevor, the bank, Wells Fargo especially, has their own wealth management division through Abbott Downing, I believe. And there are a lot of them out there. It would be a good idea for you to at least research some of these companies online. Personally, I think it's pointless to start interviewing them when you don't have any money. Because within the first 2 or 3 minutes, they're going to know that you don't have any money. And if you tell them you have dinar or foreign currency, they're going to act like, okay, don't waste my time. I'm done here. So wait till you have some money and then start interviewing these people. Just because you start off maybe with Abbott Downing because they're part of Wells Fargo doesn't mean you have to stay with them. You're not entering into a lifelong contract. So you need to work with people you're comfortable with, like anything else.
Here's a suggestion, jumping in there for a second. If you start with Abbott Downey, go find another company, hire them too, and have them review what Abbott Downey says and have Abbott Downey review what they say.
Good plan.
It may cost you a little more money, but you're getting a really sage advice, and you're putting both of them on notice that, you know, their competition is evaluating their suggestions. Maybe they'll come up with better suggestions.
Good idea.
So, yeah, I have my
moment. A little competition is always a good thing, right?
That's right.
Yeah. So for those of you who really aren't familiar with the trust that we have, as I said, the beauty of this trust is you can be your own trustee. This trust is not a trust as most people are aware of it or are comfortable with. A trust is actually a contract in trust format. It's got extensive history, legal precedents going back long before this country was even founded. You know, we've talked about corporations, LLCs, statutory trusts. Our contract trust precedes any of those. As Jim says, goes back to really the 1400s. And, you know, I heard a long, long time ago that Plato built the first university in Greece, funded it by raising money with a trust. I mean, how long ago was that, really? It was long before my time. But all these things are available. They all have their good place. But as far as protecting this money, estate planning, and asset protection, this is the best way to go. They're very easy to set up. We have a third-party curator who is someone that you choose, and you go to this person and you say, in this case, let's say Jim. I go to Jim and say, Jim, I'd like to set up a trust. Can you help me out?
Sure. Yeah, so go ahead.
So let's just walk through it. So I would like to set up a trust. Jim, I've got some assets I'd like to put in there. Can you help me out?
Sure. First thing we need to do is find a creator, somebody that can create the contract for you, and then we will look around and see what we can find as far as a trustee. You'll need to exchange some assets in there, and we'll need 21 lawful dollars to start creating the contract. And then after we get it all set up, since the creator would be looking for the most knowledgeable person to manage his assets, you probably qualify because you're going to be the ex-owner of these assets. So you could probably become the trustee. So
that sounds good to me because I know more about this than anybody else. So I think, you know, I've had it all this time. I was smart enough to buy it. Seems logical that I would be the one to continue to manage it. Wow. So can I get my husband involved?
Sure. You can make him a co-trustee. You can create a position called executive trustee. You or he both can be executive trustees. But you're also going to need some successor trustees in case something should happen to you or you decide you want to retire early. So you'd have to set up a contract with successor trustees. And then if you decide
I can name one of my kids to do that?
Sure. Sure you can. In fact, we have a bloodline clause. If you want to keep it in the family, we can do it that way. So we all also have a spendthrift clause in there, you know, to make sure that nobody abuses the trust. And then the last thing that you're going to need to do is once you get all this established, you're probably going to have to hire some people. You could actually appoint some officers if you wanted to actually do the day-to-day operation of the trust. You could hire a president or a vice president or secretary or treasurer to actually manage some of the affairs of the trust. So it takes the burden off of you, Carol.
So, but I still have final say, right?
Exactly. You have all the say.
Yeah. That's what I understand about trustees. The trustees' word is it, you know. So you hire, I can hire a president, but then he still has to come to me if he wants to go out and buy something expensive, right?
Yes, he serves at the pleasure of the executive trustees.
Oh, I like that. I like that. And so what do I get? I put all my assets, in this case my currency, into this trust. What do I get back?
Well, you get certificates of beneficial interest. And those are a unique animal in as much as, in fact, I can just tell you, certificate holders are devoid of legal rights. They have no officers, and they must remain forever mute as the selection, approval, or disapproval of the trustee and their methods of conduct of the business affairs that would make the trustee an absolute owner. So that's Bouchard versus First People's Trust. So there's court cases that tell you exactly what you can do and what those positions will be. So as a certificate holder, you have beneficial interest in the trust, but that is it. Upon somebody's departure or demise, they become null and void, go back to the trust. And then the Board of Trustees will reissue those to another certificate holder, which will probably be a family member. Does that work for you?
Yeah, that sounds really good. Now, this is obviously not going to happen, folks. This is just an example. Let's say my husband and I get divorced, and he doesn't want to have anything to do with his trust. What do we do with that?
Well, he just resigns. He just says, I don't want to play this game anymore. I don't want to be trustee. He submits a resignation that he doesn't want to do that, and then he's just taken out his certificates of beneficial interest, go back into the trust, and they're reissued to whoever you want to bring in.
Oh, okay. And the same thing, I would think the same thing would apply if he's ill or mentally incompetent.
Absolutely. Even if it's just temporary, if accidents and you're in the hospital like I was recently, you know, I can put somebody in my stead temporarily. So it's all set up for that. So I resigned temporarily, and then I was reassigned once I was able to take over the affairs.
Yeah, well, that sounds like it would work for me. So how much is this sucker going to cost me?
Well, such a deal we got for you. $1,495 is the going rate right now. And when I was in the business before we met, I was selling between $4,500 and $8,500, depending on how complex it was and how many I had to set up for people. So it's a good deal.
So were Jay and I. Yeah. It's a very good deal. Yeah. So, and we do take all major credit cards. And, you know, we're happy to work with you to make it work for you. You know, once again, we do feel that this is the best asset protection you can get. Can anybody else, you know, I've unfortunately got some bad credit history. Can anybody come after the assets of the trust for my issues?
No, they can't, because the trust is an entity in itself. You simply work for the trust. So if you're just a trustee, you're just basically a hired gun to manage it. It has nothing to do with you. So they can't get anything out of the trust to satisfy a debt that you've created.
Oh, okay. So how do I get money out of the trust?
We need to have somebody mute some stuff that we have
yes,
in the background.
Yes, please. I can figure who that is. Hang on here. Okay. All of you, would you please hit star 6? There's some baby crying in the background.
And it sounds like a pinging of a smoke alarm.
No, I don't hear that. Anyway, I would appreciate it if you could all hit star 6, please. Several of you have, several have not. Anyway, let's talk about how to get money out of the trust.
Well, since you work for the trust, basically, since you don't own it, it can pay you a salary. It can pay for your car. It can pay your travel. It can pay your utilities. It can pay for your rent. It can pay your house payments. Because you're an employee, it's a benefit package that you establish as an employee of the trust. And, of course, it would issue you a debit card. Of course, the trust is going to have an account. And as trustee, you have to manage the trust itself. So you have a debit card, a checking account, however you want to do it. And everything is done for the benefit of the trust. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that's taxable income to me, though, right?
Well, it depends. It depends on how you set up your life. I mean, it could be, and it might not be. You know, is the benefit package taxable to you? It is, in some instances, a car sometimes, a house sometimes, depends on how you set it up. If the trust owned the house, or if there was a house in a trust, then that might not be, because you have the right to live there if you're the trustee.
Yeah. So there's apparently a lot of ways to set things up, so to your benefit.
Oh, yes, yes. It can be orchestrated, and that's one unique thing about this animal, about the trust. It can be structured. I don't like that term, but we have to use it. It can be structured for the benefit of the trustee more so than anything else in some cases. Now, mm-hmm. if it's going to be used to hold a trust to hold an automobile, for an example, which I have, my car is in a trust, I do put a little bit of money in that thing, and when I set it up, I put some extra money in the trust just to be able to take care of the car, mostly just for the registration fees, state fees, things like that, insurance. And it pays it. So I have accounts set up for that trust.
So I think it's a good idea. You're talking about putting cars and maybe even houses in separate trusts, or can we keep them all in the same trust with all the money?
No, you don't want to keep anything in with the money. You want to separate out your assets. So let's use an example. You have a car. You put it in a trust. And then you're driving the car on a two-lane road. You're doing 50 mile an hour coming towards a car. That's approximately 65 feet per second. The car coming at you is going 65 feet per second. That's about 130 feet per second closure rate. If one of you sneezes at the wrong time, you might have head-on collision. So what happens then is whatever's in the trust can be taken by lawsuit. So the only thing in that trust is that car. That's the only thing they can get. They can go after you because you were the driver, but that has nothing to do with the trust. You'll have insurance anyway for that. So whatever the trust had as corpus could be taken from a lawsuit, but the only thing they're going to get is just the car because you've segregated the car into a separate trust. If you had it in the money trust, they might be able to get quite a bit of that money too. So same with a house. Same with a house. Most people don't understand that a house has got quite a bit of liability. Somebody walking up to the house slips and falls, breaks an ankle on the steps, you're liable. If the house is in a trust, all they can do is get what the trust has in it, worst case scenario. But you also have homeowner's insurance and stuff like that to take care of.
Umbrella policy, right?
Exactly. You want to have an umbrella policy over everything. But you want to have each one of these articles, each one of these items in a separate trust.
Let me interject for a moment, Jim. I heard a long time ago, maybe some of the people on the call remember, Ted Kennedy, and this girl died in a car when they drove off a bridge in Chappaquiddick, I think it was.
Yes,
and
it was.
That car was in a trust, as I recall, and all they got was the car, and I think Kennedy paid the family some money out of guilt, but they did not legally need to. Is that how you remember it?
Well, yeah, the rest of the details is this. The car was in trust. They had an insurance policy on the car. When he crashed the car and she died, they got the maximum amount that was in the insurance policy. And I read some places only $100,000, but back then that was quite a bit of money. But everything that Kennedy had was in trust. I mean, they had hundreds and hundreds of trusts. And so all they got was that settlement. But then he paid some out of guilt from his salary as a legislator for quite some time to the family. But that was all they were entitled to, was the insurance policy in that trust and the car.
And the car.
Yeah.
Anyway, I think this is probably a good time for a break and see if anybody has any questions. So, folks, if you have any questions, please star 6 and raise your hand. And in the meantime, Jim and I will keep talking.
Well, I've got a list of...
We both like to talk.
Yeah. So until somebody says something, so some of the cases are Bouchard versus First People's Trust, the right to contract under Schumann-Hank versus Folsom. Supreme Court's held that recognized that the freedom to make contracts and have been enforced in the courts as a part of the bundle of rights protected by the due process. That's under Patterson versus Bank Eudora and Mueller versus Oregon. A trust contract is established by private parties for personal purposes, not registered with the state, the corporate commissioner, to comply with the statutes relating to incorporating and does not invalidate the trust organization. It's Hodgkiss versus Northern Petroleum and Consolidated. We just got case after case. Certificate holders of the trust contract enjoy an even greater immunity from personal liability as accorded to the stockholders of a corporation. Goldman versus Altman. That's a very famous case.
And we might add, we mentioned we give you a lot of legal backup, all of which is on the website. But when you get your trust, you also get a little PDF drive. And we have five books on there. And book number five is legal backup. And it's, I think, about 20 pages of legal backup.
And then
we go back a long ways.
Right. And the interesting thing here, since we had an attorney make a rude comment, which we've corrected, business trusts are found in Corpus Juris Secundum and American Jurisprudence Second Edition. The individuals say, well, they don't really exist. Yeah, they do. The problem with the attorneys is we are competing with them. They don't like that.
And so this is common law, and attorneys
right.
aren't typically schooled in common law anymore. Is that correct?
That's true. So it says here, business trusts are recognized under the term common law trust, the 88 American Law Reports, third edition, citing Schumann, Hank versus Folsom. So it's in there. It says that they are under common law, and it's recognized. It's citing Schumann. So, they can't say it doesn't exist.
Because it does. It's been around longer than they have been, that's for sure.
Yeah.
So, Judy, do you have any questions this morning? Judy, are you there?
Yeah, I'm right here, Carol. I'm fascinated by listening to both of you. It's just, you're so informative.
Okay, do you have any questions this morning, sweetie?
No, I'm good this morning. I don't have any.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you,
honey. All right. Okay, let's see. Kathy, do you have any questions? I'm just calling on names that I see that I recognize here, and I can't unmute you for some reason. Well, Jim, we must be doing a pretty good job because nobody's got any questions.
Wow. Swells my head for me. Thank you.
maybe I need to, I don't know, I think I have this. Oh, let's try this one. There we go. Now, *6, folks, let me unmute Jim and unmute Judy. Okay. No wonder I didn't see any hands. Anyway, *6, if you have a question, folks, we'd be happy to answer it. And I know we're kind of all over the place today, but we do feel we're very, very close to this RV, everything we're all reading. I'm sure you're reading the same kind of stuff that we are. Indicates we're very, very close. So we thought we'd go into things in a little more depth today than we normally do. But the basis for this call really is the contract trust and why we think it's important for you to have one, how powerful they are, how long they've been around, and they're just a good thing to have. We do have a caller, Jen. Good morning, Mel. How are you today?
Hello, Carol. This is Melvin. How are you?
I'm well, thanks. How are you doing?
Okay, pretty good, pretty good. I have a basic question on connecting the trust to a bank account. I'm sure it's somewhere in the documentation, but I just thought I'd ask the question anyways.
Okay. When we get your trust, the first thing we do is obtain an EIN number for you, and we use that as part of the basis of the trust because you can't open a bank account without an EIN. And we also create an abstract of trust. Those are typically all the only two items you need when you go to the bank to open an account is the EIN, which the bank only confirms. And someone was concerned recently because she couldn't find her EIN letter and thought it would be a big red flag when she went to the bank. So all you really need is a number because the bank confirms it on their own end with their own link to the IRS. But the abstract of trust is merely two pages that tells the bank what the pertinent information they need. It tells them the very pertinent information about the trust itself and how you are going to interact with it with the bank. And it's something that is either witnessed or notarized. Take this to the bank and open an account. Now, I have to let you know, folks, some banks are not that familiar with trust. One of the reasons we took the word business out of it is because too many banks. Oh, it's a business. I want to see all your business documents. I want your registration with the state, et cetera, et cetera. Because this is a common law instrument, there is no need to register it with the state, with the county, with the city, with anybody, unless you're actively operating a business. So they're not going to be able to look up your EIN online and see that's associated with a business license because you don't need one. Do you want to add to that, Jim?
Sure. Under Hodgkiss versus Northern Petroleum Consolidated, it says the trust contract is established by private parties for personal purposes. It is not registered with the state corporation commissioner or comply with the statutes relating to incorporating and does not invalidate the trust organization. So the only thing that we can add to that is make sure that if anybody gets you an EI number, make sure it's the right one. In other words, we have a couple clients that wanted to send us EI numbers. Well, we found out one of them didn't do it right because they didn't put it down as irrevocable trust. And then when they went to try and get a bank account, this is recently here in Oregon, they couldn't get the account opened up because they didn't have an EI number that that qualified. It wasn't what the contract said. So we had to refile. So if you have to have the EI match when you go to the bank, what the document says.
That's why we prefer to do it for you.
Exactly.
Also, some folks have opened bank accounts a long time ago, and the accounts were closed for inactivity and service fees. You know, Wells Fargo and many other banks have made thousands and thousands of dollars off of service monthly service fees on accounts that haven't done anything. So while we used to recommend you open your bank account as soon as possible, I think Jim agrees with me, that now your best bet is just to wait till this RV occurs. When you're at the bank and you've done your exchange, you have all this money, say, okay, Mr. Banker, now I would like to open an account for XYZ Trust. Here's my paperwork. They are not going to turn you down.
No,
they are
going to
want. They want to keep as much money in their bank as possible. And just because you exchange it at Wells Fargo or Chase or whatever bank you exchange with, or HSBC, and you do open an account there, doesn't mean that you have to keep it there. You can open subsequent accounts at other banks. And you can have as many accounts for XYZ Trust as you want to. And personally, I've got my Mother Lode Trust. I've got three different bank accounts for it right now. Unfortunately, it's just costing me monthly fees. But once you get there and you have all this money, you can put the money in an account there and walk across the street to a different bank and wire transfer some of that money over, write a check, whatever, move some of it, all of it, a portion of it to a different bank account if you like. And actually, I would recommend that. You know, the old saying, you don't want to keep all your eggs in one basket. So opening a bank account is really not that difficult. Does that answer your question, Melvin?
Oh, yes, absolutely, absolutely. I have another one.
Sure.
There's some talk about having separate accounts for each type of currency. Is that something that is recommended, or it's a matter of, you know, preference?
Okay, the important word there is accounts.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you don't have to have separate trusts for each currency, but separate bank accounts. So let's just say you've got the squirrel trust, because I'm watching a squirrel out of my back fence here. You've got the squirrel trust. So under that squirrel trust, you're going to open an account for the dinar. For the money,
okay.
Obviously, folks, when I say dinar, you're not putting dinar in the bank. But open an account for the money that comes from the dinar, an account that comes from the dong, an account that comes from the ZIM, Rupiah, Rial, whatever. Same trust with all these different sub-accounts. And the bank will do that for you. I think they would probably prefer it. It seems to me, I read a long time ago, that the dinar is going to be handled differently internally than the other currencies. I don't know if that's still true. I do believe that we're still looking at this not being a taxable event on any level now. It used to be we worried about the state level. From what I've read, it's not even going to be taxable on the state level. But, you know, we're not going to know that for sure until we see it. But I do believe it's not going to be taxable on the federal level. Have you heard anything different, Jim?
No, I haven't, but let's go talk about it for a second. I travel, haven't traveled much lately, but I used to travel internationally a lot. And I never had to pay taxes when I exchanged my currency back to the U.S. dollar. When I was going back and forth to Hong Kong, I just took the money to the local airport and just exchanged it back to U.S. dollars. Nobody was asking any questions. So that's the premise behind this, that we shouldn't have a taxable event here because we're just exchanging currency.
And that's one thing. I'm glad you brought that up. There's a form that they're going to fill out at the bank. It used to be a paper form, but now it's a computer form, and they'll just ask you some questions. Make sure you say this is a currency exchange. If
yeah.
you call it anything else in a currency exchange, it will be taxable. But if you, you know, make sure to tell them this is a currency exchange, it is not a taxable event. So I do not recall the number of that form. But I know they just ask you questions now. They don't even tell you that they're filling out a form. They just go ahead and ask you questions. So make sure you know, that it's very clear. This is a currency exchange. You should be okay.
Okay. And the EIN, would have a separate EIN for each account, or
no,
how does that work?
The EIN applies to the trust. So the Squirrel Trust has EIN 91-12345, whatever it is.
Gotcha. Okay.
And you're going to have a Squirrel Trust master account, and then you're going to have all these sub-accounts with the different currencies underneath it.
Okay.
Okay?
I'm good.
All right.
Thanks, Kevin.
All right. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Jim, what about maybe somebody wants to buy a new house? Are they going to just... How do they take the money out of the trust without it being taxable to them?
Well, if you're going to buy a new house, you're going to want to create a trust for the house. And you fund that trust from your mother lode trust for the purchase of the house. Plus, you're going to put enough money in there to take care of the taxes for at least 1 or 2 years and some maintenance money. So you would fund that trust from the mother lode trust, and then that trust would go buy a house. You as the agent,
oh,
you as trustee, would go find something you want.
Oh, I like that idea. That sounds pretty good. You know, actually, one of my clients suggested some time ago to fund that real estate trust with enough money to invest in some way so that it keeps earning, so there's always enough money in there so it self-funds to pay taxes, to pay for maintenance, et cetera, et cetera. So, and that's not a bad idea. You know, put an extra $10,000, $50,000 in that real estate trust. Put it to work somehow. So the money that it makes will continue to pay all the real estate taxes, insurance, maintenance, et cetera, et cetera.
Another suggestion on that, and I haven't thoroughly vetted this idea, also I'll throw it out. I admit it's a half-baked idea yet. I haven't done all of my due diligence. But you can do a reverse mortgage. You're going to pay cash for the house anyway. You should. And just do a reverse mortgage. At the end of the term, then the house is taken out of the trust, and then you put another one in there. Or you just hold the trust and start a new trust.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
From what I understand about financing reverse mortgage is kind of like financing. You will have to flip it out of the trust to get the reverse mortgage and then immediately put it back in the trust. I mean, I have done this for clients. It works flawlessly. But they cannot do the reverse mortgage on a house that belongs to a trust. That doesn't mean you can't put it back into the trust immediately after you get the money.
Perfect. That'll work.
Yeah.
Okay. Sure. So, I mean, the mechanism of flipping a house out of a trust and then back into a trust, want to touch on that just a little bit?
Sure.
Go ahead.
Oh, I thought you wanted me. You were going to.
No, I'll let you do this.
It's just a matter of paperwork. You know, when you... let's say you have a house currently that you just want to pay off and put it into a trust. You're going to have to quit claim it from yourself to the trust. So back to the scenario about doing a reverse mortgage, the trust will have to quit claim it back to you. So the ownership of the house is no longer in the Squirrel Trust. It's in your name. So as soon as you get the new financing, whether you currently, if you're refinancing, if you're doing reverse mortgage, as soon as the ink is dry, as soon as you get the money, you then quit claim it back to the trust. It's a very simple mechanism, and when the time comes, we'll be able to assist you with that to some degree. I'm not saying we're going to do it for you, but we'll be able to assist you to some degree and be happy to do so. But you know, the same thing holds true with cars. You know, you can form your mother lode trust and spin off another trust to fund your new cars. If you're planning on buying a whole bunch of cars, you might consider, okay, well, maybe I just need a leasing company. Let the leasing company trust own all these half a dozen cars that I want to buy. And then lease the car back to myself. Something to that effect.
Mm-hmm. I got an interesting story about that. I've had a trust that I've registered with the Department of Motor Vehicles in Oregon. It's called MBZ Trust, and I started out with little Mercedes-Benz, and I've kept the trust active. I moved cars in and out of it, and about a year and a half ago, when I moved my present car into it, it went down to DMV, and the guy looked at it and says, oh, this is your case. We studied your case. You've got all these cars coming in and out of this trust, and you know we have no problem with it. And so evidently, I was the guinea pig. Set these things up years ago. So all I do is move it in there, and I sign it in a specific way. I just put my name, executive trustee, comma, and not as otherwise. And that was one of the things he commented out, is they had to have their attorney look at that. So that's perfectly legal. It's a perfect way to do it. And so it was just an interesting thing that the guy recognized the name of the trust and made a comment about it. So I set that trust up in 90. I bought that car in 94, and it's still a valid trust registered with us, with DMV. You don't have to register them with DMV. Let's change that. It's a valid trust that DMV recognizes that I've been using for years. They call it registering the trust because you're registering a car, but you're registering the car in a trust. So they just call it registering the trust.
Yeah.
It's a misnomer. But I thought that was interesting that it's been around since 94.
We have another client who lives in Washington. He lives in Washington, but one of his cars is still licensed in Oregon to a trust. So he's gotten stopped. You know, this guy's got a pretty heavy foot. He's gotten stopped for speeding several times, and as soon as they see that the car is owned by a trust, they say, okay, just slow down next time. He's never gotten a ticket since he's had the trust. He's crossed toll bridges without ever having to pay because they don't have any place. You know, they can send a bill to somewhere, but they don't know who owns the trust. I don't recommend that. it does show you the power of the trust. It really does.
All right. Now you really hit a sore spot with me. I had a car, and I was going from Seattle down to Salem in a hurry because my father was ill, and I did not have that particular automobile in trust at the time. I just got it a short time ago, you know, type thing, and I got my first speeding ticket in 30 years on that one. And if I had it in a trust, I would not have got a speeding ticket.
You're right. No. Just a little added benefit. Just a little added benefit.
Yeah. It cost me $300 and some odd to drive 7 miles an hour over the speed limit.
Oh, my goodness. Wow.
I know.
Yeah. Anyway, folks, it's about 10 minutes of the hour, and I am expecting someone here in a few minutes. So I think we should let it go for today. Unless we have any more questions, please raise your hand. Star 6. I don't see anybody here.
Okay, well, in closing, let me say this. I'm going to add this sheet to the website. I'll make it on the public side shortly. Probably by tomorrow I'll have it done. I want to reformat it so it looks good and does everything, and there's a couple typos I want to confirm that are typos or maybe the way they spelled things. But it's about 25 or 30 cases here that I want people to have. So it'll be on the outside of the trust. There'll be a button at the top that you can push to download it.
Okay. You want to give them your contact information, Jim?
Sure. I'm in Salem, Oregon, so keep that in mind. I'm Pacific Time. My phone number is 503-583-6791. And the best email to get me at is security@indicatorinformation securityatindicatorinformation.com. That's securityatindicatorinformation.com. And I usually take calls between 9 and 6 every day. I don't answer the phone before 9 because I haven't had enough caffeine yet, generally speaking. So.
There you go. Thank you, Jim. Thank you for assisting me today. Again, folks, my name is Carol Werlius. My telephone number is 425-820-8090. I'm in Central Time right now. Right now it's about 1 o'clock, and like Jim, I typically take calls between 9:30 and 5:36, something like that. But like Jim, you know, we're pretty much available. We do, as I said, we do answer our calls. We do answer our emails. My email is info@indicator.com. Jim and I both look forward to hearing from you. We are all looking forward to 800 numbers. And if I get them, folks, I will let you know. So take care, everybody. Have a great weekend, and go RV. Thank you for joining us. Bye-bye.